A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast on this fine Monday morning. And by fine, I mean 6 degrees. That's it for your weather update. It's just really, really cold in the UK and TBC on whether it's ever going to get any warmer. Matt is here experiencing the very same weather that I'm experiencing just a few miles down the road. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm very well, thank you. And I played tennis this morning, which was fun. I didn't text the group, so that probably tells you all you need to know about how I played. But Jack Draper,
that never stops me.
Bumped into him.
Oh,
One day you're losing to Hubert Hurkacz in Madrid, and the next you're playing on the same court as I am. It's a weird life being a tennis player.
David's here. Hello, David. Since we last spoke, you have acquired top-of-the-range athlete-level wearable tech and been on a lad's golfing holiday.
Yeah.
Who are you? Who is this man I see before me?
Spring does funny things to me, and it's not 6 degrees here either. It's a lot warmer than that. So, you know, come to some sunny Solihull and you end up wearing wearable tech and going on lads holiday. First time I'd been in one in 30 years, and it was with the same people. We're mostly different shapes than we used to be 30 years ago, but still, we got along famously, and golf was just as bad as it used to be. So, yes, vintage.
The content absolutely was vintage. I enjoyed it very much. I've been to Guernsey since we last spoke. I played paddle a couple of days ago with the UK's number one junior, a lovely chap called Liam, who took every shot, basically.
Have you introduced him to tennis? You know,
he started off as a tennis player, I believe. Now, I would like to set the record straight here. Some people, when I posted
rumors
the content
are flying around.
When I posted the content on Instagram, there were people saying some very quite frankly slanderous things about pickleball, and I would like it to be known that I have never and probably will never play pickleball. I certainly didn't in Guernsey. I played paddle, very different thing, significantly less offensive in my view, and very good fun. I enjoyed it. It's no tennis, folks, but I do think there is a world in which paddle and tennis can happily coexist, and I don't quite feel the same way about pickleball. I think it's more of an existential threat. Anyway, this is not the Pickleball Podcast, nor will it ever be. This is the Tennis Podcast, and we have Madrid things to talk about. Prepare yourself to be confused, folks. We've had 6 days of the women's tournament, 5 of the men's. The men are at the round of 16 / round of 32 stage. They're straddling the two rounds. The women are all at the round of 16 stage. Sorry to harp on about this, but I do think it bears repeating. In the words of Caroline Garcia, we've been here for a week and we've played 2 matches. It moves slowly. You don't do much. You just wait. This format is a bit frustrating. Some might resonate with it, but I can't. Those are the words of both Caroline Garcia and Catherine Whittaker. I know we've said it all before, but every time I experience, particularly week one of a 2-week Masters long event, frankly, I grow to hate it even more. Do you guys share that opinion? Do you feel differently? Am I just a grump? You feel differently.
I do.
Off you go, David.
And you may remember, if you were to rewind a year ago to when we were doing this for the first time, I would have been agreeing with you. And there's still lots that bugs me about it. Let's also see what I'm saying in a week's time when I've had the part of the tournament where there's not so much going on. We very much need to factor the whole thing in as a whole. But I did just think, and I realised this might be a "oh, tennis podcaster likes having a lad's holiday" element to it. But I think it is good to miss stuff occasionally and to have a break. And I think that this format allows you to have a few days when my mum isn't saying, "God, it's on all the time, isn't it? Every week, you know, we all had a break. You went off to Guernsey. I went on a lad's holiday. People sort of probably didn't bother with Tuesday and Wednesday too much because it's not that good. And as wonderful as those 1 week masters are, I think that's a bit much. That is like going Madrid to Rome and then just cramming all this stuff into 7 days, lovely, in isolation. But I think that is difficult for the players to keep that up. I think there are difficult elements to this. I remember Andy Murray saying, like, when do you get a mental break if you're just going to a tournament rather than having a week off, say? I do understand that. But I also think that is the generation that's been brought up with the 1 week version. And nobody likes change, do they, when it's imposed upon them? But the ones that are coming up, they don't know that. They're just going to get used to this. I think that I've quite enjoyed being able to know that I could have a few days not really bothering about the tennis too much. There wasn't another tournament going on. And now I've been up for it. The last few days I've come back and I've really enjoyed it.
Well, you've played your hand very well there, David, because obviously it's very, very hard to disagree with an argument that presses the "there's too much tennis" button, because I will never not agree with that. But I put to you, what about having a fallow 5 days where there's no tennis and starting the Masters over, so they run over, you know, 9 days, they can have 2 weekends. But the 5 days in the week leading up to that isn't, you know, week one of Madrid or week one of Rome. It's fallow time with no tournament where they can go and have a couple of days off, or they can go and have a training block to actually work on something technical or physical if they like.
Yeah, I think that'd be a very good idea. I think that would be an improvement on what I've just described, and would achieve the same thing but better. I suppose there's a business model argument where they might say, "Oh well, yeah, this enables us to sell more, etc." But no, from a spectator's perspective, you would be achieving what I'm after, and I definitely think that this weekend and now this Monday that we're talking today, these are really cool days of loads and loads of matches. So yeah, I do think that would be ideal.
Matt, you just want to sort out the shadow, don't you? Matt's like, I'll watch tennis anytime, so long as there's not an unwatchable shadow descending across the court.
Yeah, I literally do skip from court to court and decide what to watch based on how bad the shadow is. That is how I approach my watching tennis these days. I think personally that, to me, I've had the same experience as I've always had with these 2 week Masters events during Madrid. Like, exactly as you said, the first few days I'm just thinking, please just get on with this tournament. And then, you know, from sort of Friday through to about Tuesday, I think it's really good. Like, there's so much tennis, it's packed order of plays, you know, it's buzzing. But I do think we're going to get to Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and look at the schedule, and there's only a handful of matches on it, and it will feel quite slow. They just have a weird rhythm to me, these events, that I can't quite get behind. And yeah, personally, I would support either 1 week Masters 1000 events like we used to have, but I take David's point about not wanting to play them back to back, just have a week off in between, or if they want to get extra weekends in, yeah, have a few days off and stretch them out over 9 days rather than 12 or 13. I'm still not satisfied with the new 2 week Masters 1000 events. I sort of think, who do you think you are? Like, Grand Slams are 2 weeks. Why do you need to be 2 weeks as well? Like, it's just so long.
Madrid, who do you think you are? Right, having largely condemned the tournament, let's talk about it. Let's start with the men, because I think that's where, so far at least, the biggest story has resided, and that is the resurgent Rafael Nadal. Back-to-back wins. On his comeback, he beat the 16-year-old wildcard Darwin Blanche, won and love, in the opening round, and then got revenge for his Barcelona defeat of a couple of weeks ago by beating Alex de Minaur 7-6, 6-3 in a kind of greatest hits of a Rafael Nadal matchup on the Manolo Santana Stadium a couple of days ago. He now faces Pedro Cachin later on today. Let's jump straight in at the triple fist pump for Rafael Nadal against Alex de Minaur. And I jumped straight in there because I absolutely knew the face that Matt Roberts was going to pull at the mere mention of it. Because, you know, we often talk about the, you know, in respect of Rafael Nadal and Andy Murray this year, and we talked about it with Serena Williams at the time when we knew that she had signalled her intent to retire or evolve away from tennis, rather. It's about moments, isn't it? We try and not fixate on results and achievements. We try and make it about moments that encapsulate them as athletes and encapsulate what they've given the sport and given us over the course of their careers. And that triple fist pump was exactly that from Rafael Nadal.
Oh, it sure was. I had such intense FOMO during this, because generally there's no place I'd rather be than Craven Cottage on a Saturday afternoon, and that's where I was watching Fulham, you know, in a fairly lackluster end of season game. And I have sort of very sporadic signal at Craven Cottage. I get sort of no messages, and then suddenly I get like 20 all at once. And I suddenly got a load from you two on the WhatsApp group, and I just knew that Rafael Nadal things were happening. And, you know, as happy as I was at Fulham, there was part of me thinking, God, I would love to be watching Rafael Nadal right now. So I did a full rewatch when I got home, watched the whole thing. And honestly, I think that's exactly right. There were some real greatest hits moments. Like, I don't think Rafael Nadal is playing anywhere near as well as Rafael Nadal has done at times in the past. I think that would be totally wrong to suggest that his level is anything close to like it was at the height of his powers. It's still a very good level that he's sometimes able to reach, because he's Rafael Nadal. He's extraordinary, and he's on a clay court. He can make amazing things happen. But let's just say that straight up, even though we're talking about sort of greatest hits, this isn't peak Rafael Nadal by any means, but you can still get these amazing moments. And honestly, quite early on in this match, I got the sense that this was a different Rafael Nadal to the one who'd played Alex de Minaur in Barcelona. Honestly, when he got so worked up about that call that Fergus Murphy made, which, look, I think sort of maybe by the strictest letter of the law, Fergus Murphy was correct. You know, Nadal didn't sort of pointedly say that he was challenging, but it was pretty obvious that he had stopped the point. And anyway,
I think Fergus Murphy had a shocker there, which is fine. Mistakes get made, but I do think that was a shocker.
And Nadal got so worked up about it, which is something that you don't normally see. He's normally so good at just putting those things behind him. But to me, that was the first sort of tell that maybe he thought there was a chance that he could actually sort of win this match. He was hyper competitive and focused and determined. And yeah, we then got these moments throughout the match. I think the triple fist pump came after he'd won that first set in a tie break, where he'd had four set points and Alex de Minaur had saved them all, and it was back level again in the tiebreak. And then suddenly Nadal hit this incredible backhand cross-court winner and then claimed the set on the next point. And yeah, this lawnmower-style fist pump that Nadal has done throughout his career. And I sort of felt like the intensity of the match was heightened by the fact that the roof was on and all the noise was kept in. And I've seen Nadal sort of power Spain to Davis Cup glory in that stadium, and I know the impact that his energy can have on the rest of the stadium. And there was just this feeling that everyone was witnessing something that maybe they thought they wouldn't see again. And it was just so, so special. And he did another incredible backhand cross-court winner to set up match point in the second set as well. I really think his backhand is maybe his best shot at the moment. He's able to sort of drive through it in a way that he's doing sometimes on his forehand, but maybe not quite as much as we've seen in the past. And yeah, it was, I think, the first time he's won a match this season that's gone beyond an hour and a half. So like a good sign that his sort of physicality is maybe starting to come back a bit. And yeah, like some of his best tennis was there in the really important moments. You know, at the end of that first set, he managed to find it right at the end of the match to break as well. And oh, it gave me all the feels seeing Rafa Nadal do that.
Yeah, I actually, personally, David, I think that roof on hothouse atmosphere was a huge factor in the match on both sides of the net. I mean, obviously it was a boost for Nadal, but this was such a different de Minaur to what we saw in Barcelona. I thought he was really cowed by it, actually. He looked so nervous, particularly in the opening stages, and obviously that dissipated over the course of the match, but he looked quite, I thought, hamstrung over the course of that couple of hours. I think it really was intimidating, even for as incredible a competitor as de Minaur is. How changed are you in your view of what Rafael Nadal is capable of off the back of this performance? Personally, my feeling is trying desperately not to allow myself to get carried away. I really do think this does not mean that he's going to win Roland Garros, but it does alleviate my fears of it being sad or uncomfortable at Roland Garros, which is what I've been worried about for the past few months, really.
Yeah, understandably so. And I still have those fears because I feel like his body's hanging by a thread, really. At any time, something could go and it could get sad, but it would also be emotional, and that stuff happens, you know. I kind of almost hope that it all would happen maybe even during a match or something like that, that if it was going to, rather than him not be able to take to the court, so that people could show their appreciation. I don't know, I haven't really thought that through, but generally speaking, I think it's all about the body. Because I think that tennis is in there. He knows that tennis is in there. He said it is. And he's not in doubt. And he knows the rhythms of these tournaments to build up to Roland Garros. Well, what are we, two matches in Madrid? The tournament he doesn't play as well in. Still Rome to come. Just imagine if he doesn't get injured anymore. Just imagine if he manages to come through the next month physically unscathed. You telling me that Rafael Nadal is not going to improve every single round that he plays between now and the French Open final? Because...
What?
I'm telling you. This guy can do anything still if he is fit. And I know that he's impeded on the serve at the moment. And I know he looks nothing like... I totally agree with Matt. He looks nothing like the guy who won Roland Garros all the times. But I don't even think he did 2 years ago when he won the tournament. I'm not saying right now Nadal will win the French Open. But I just feel like he's going to get better and better.
I did a Matt Roberts and looked up the French Open odds. And this was during set one of the de Minaur match, okay? Would anybody like to hazard a guess at where they have Rafael Nadal in the order of favourites. Hazard a guess at where they have them, and let us know where you would have him.
I would guess that they would have him third or fourth favourite.
And you would have him?
Do you know, I think probably a little bit lower than that. I think that Alex de Minaur on clay is not quite the level of opponent that I think, for example, Alcaraz, Sinner, Djokovic, Ruud. I'd probably throw Zverev in there at Roland Garros as well. You know, like think how tough it was for Nadal to try and beat Zverev at Roland Garros 2 years ago. I think probably I'd put him sixth or seventh right now, I suppose. And even that feels pretty bonkers, to be honest.
Yeah, the bookies had him fourth behind Sinner, Djokovic and Alcaraz. And I think that's pretty ludicrous, really. I definitely wouldn't have him ahead of Zverev, Tsitsipas, you know, Monte Carlo champion, Stefanos Tsitsipas. Who else? What other Ruud definitely wouldn't have him ahead of Ruud. But, you know, he's got time to convince me. I don't know.
I am finding all the stuff Nadal's saying quite difficult to grasp. You know, one week he's talking about dying on the court at Roland Garros. Then a few days later, he's entering Laver Cup. Then he's starting Madrid by saying that he wouldn't play Roland Garros if he was feeling how he's currently feeling. And then he's beating Alex de Minaur. And then he puts it in his own words and he says, I try to play at my 100%, but I can't give my 100% every day. The thing is, most of the time, I was able to give my 100% of the 100%. Today, I'm able to give my 100% of sometimes 40%, sometimes 60%, sometimes 70%. And so, oh, well, that's cleared it up. Thanks. Thanks, Rafa. I think basically what he's saying is he's going to try his best, but he doesn't know on a day-to-day basis whether he's going to be feeling 50% or 70%, but you know he's going to make the absolute most of what he's got. And I think the point is that that can take him pretty far.
It is unusually chaotic, the the comments that Rafael Nadal is throwing out there, because after, well, Matt just detailed it there, but also, you know, he's going to die on the court at Roland Garros, but then be resurrected on the same court to play doubles with Carlos Alcaraz at the Olympics. It's unusual from him for the track to change so much, and perhaps is indicative of how differently he feels physically day to day. It's a bit of a strange one. Look, I'm here for all of it. Please do resurrect Rafael Nadal so he can play doubles with Carlos Alcaraz at the Olympics. Nobody doesn't want to see that. But yeah, okay. So we'll see. We'll reconvene this gang on Thursday, and we'll see how much more we've learned about Rafael Nadal in the intervening 3 days.
Obviously, the risk of doing extremely out-of-date tennis news is very high as we're in the middle of the tournament, but his draw has opened up in Madrid in that he's got Pedro Cachin next, who obviously, you know, knows his way around the clay court, would sort of be the cliche you would say about him, but came into Madrid totally out of form. I think he'd lost 15 matches in a row prior to this tournament, and he's had a couple of good wins here. But I think also Tsitsipas was in that section, but he's gone out. So, you know, there are opportunities for Nadal to maybe get a couple more matches under his belt. And I think sort of, as we've said, the more he plays, the more I think, well, the better I think he'll get, the more we'll learn about him. But there is just part of me that is worried about, you know, too much tennis almost, and that taking a toll on its body. I just don't know how much he can push it before Roland Garros.
Having said I would comfortably put Stefanos Tsitsipas ahead of Rafael Nadal in the list of French Open favourites. As Matt said there, he has already lost in Madrid, beaten 4-4 by Thiago Monteiro. Do we put this down to Madrid being a bit weird? Sometimes weird things happen.
I think you put it down to it being weird, yes, certainly to a degree. But also, I said the other week, I think he's playing too much. I don't. You can't play all of these, I don't think, really, and be at your very best for everything. And I made the point, I think he could do with a mental break. So he needs to come into these things fresh. But that's just my opinion. But he got hammered by this guy. I mean, Montero was playing lights out tennis, and Tsitsipas had no answer at all.
I think part of the Tsitsipas thing might be, like, personally, I don't think it's too much to play Monte Carlo, Barcelona, Madrid, Rome, Roland Garros. Like, this is the most important part of Tsitsipas's season. I can see why he's playing all these events. I do think it's maybe an indication that, you know, there is still some finding his best level to get. Like, I know he played really well in Monte Carlo and Barcelona, but, you know, he came into this clay court season really not playing well. I think if he were to suddenly sort of play his absolute best tennis every week, that would be a sort of real departure from the form he'd been showing beforehand. Like, I still think there was some slight cracks, some slight vulnerabilities in his game. I don't think he's not the sort of finished article at the moment. He's still trying to get better, and it's perhaps expected that maybe he has these slight periods where he doesn't play so well, even on his favourite surface. But he could probably, you know, do with a decent Rome now, because you don't want to go into Roland Garros, I think, off the back of two poor Masters 1000 events in a row.
And same goes for Holger Rune, who's of course defending final points in Rome. When is a crisis for Holger Rune, David?
It's interesting because, you know, when he plays well, and it's only in these small spells of matches, I think he was brilliant for the way he came through the Dimitrov match in Monte Carlo, and there were little flashes there where he's electric. He is so good to watch. But then he just throws in these duffers of matches at times, and he blames his physicality or his ill health most of the time. There's usually an excuse.
He certainly always blames something.
He was blaming the stringer the other day. Did you see that?
I mean, look, I didn't watch all of the Griekspor match. I watched a bit of it, and Griekspor's good. You know, he's quietly very dangerous. He can beat a lot of players. His top level's high, but still, Rune is one of the guys. He's one of the players that should be in the conversation for quarterfinals at all of these tournaments and beyond. And he should win some of them too, certainly reach the final. He's that good. He just still comes across as immature and probably unprofessional to some degree in terms of the way he carries himself on court. And he just, I don't really see much that has changed since certainly a year ago. I mean, if anything, he's got worse. So he's got a lot to prove, I think. I mean, yeah, that's an early loss. Here we are on our first show and he's out. It's not very good.
Yeah, I think these are tough times for Holger Rune. I'm sure what will happen is he'll split up with Patrick Mouratoglou and then quite soon afterwards get back together with him. That seems to be how he handles a crisis. But I think he needs to do something.
And you're right about, I'd sort of forgotten, but all the points he's defending over the next couple of months. Like, he had a pretty good summer last year. It was the final of Rome, quarters at Roland Garros, Queens he did well. I can't quite remember, quarters or semis. And then quarters at Wimbledon as well. Like, there's quite a lot of points that he's got stacked up, and if his current form were to continue, his ranking will plummet, I suspect, after Wimbledon. So it's an important time for him to get it right.
Carlos Alcaraz has looked very good indeed, hasn't he? He's won through two matches so far. He's got Jan-Lennard Struff next, which I know you think, Matt, could be a little bit tricky for him. He's told us that he is still holding back a little bit on the forehand, not because he's experiencing still any pain in the forearm, but just, I think, preventative as much as anything, as he builds back confidence in that part of the body and in that shot. But look, he's got so many ways to win points, doesn't he, that not having full strength on the forehand. I mean, quite honestly, I hadn't noticed until he told us he was holding back a bit on the forehand. It's still so much bigger than everybody else's anything that I hadn't noticed. But I almost think, good, Carlos Alcaraz sort of learning to show a bit of restraint. Like, this might end up being good for him, right? It's an injury that's requiring him to learn a little bit of discipline. Maybe that'll be a good life and tennis lesson for him. But yeah, Struff's tricky, really tricky, on natural surfaces in particular, I think.
Yes, I really think so. Alcaraz is on an incredible winning streak in Madrid, isn't he? He's obviously the two-time defending champion, but I actually think last year's final against Struff was one of the toughest matches that Alcaraz has had in Madrid. I watched Struff beat Hugo Humbert the other day, and I thought he was very impressive. He's obviously coming off a title. He's full of confidence right now. That's a big test, I think, for Alcaraz. And Alcaraz did speak about the fact that he hasn't really played like a massive hitter yet, and he's sort of a little bit wary about how that arm might hold up against a bigger ball. So I think that's something to watch out for.
An agricultural ball.
Too right. But yeah, like, Madrid just fits Alcaraz so well. He does play his best tennis there in those conditions. He loves it. And yeah, I had exactly the same thought, actually. Maybe not going full pelt on the forehand all the time might be a nice development for his game generally. Obviously, you don't want him to be injured, but you know, he can do so much damage with that shot, even if he's not fully going after it all the time, and he's got so much variation and other elements to his game as well. Yeah, like, it's been really encouraging how he's played so far, but yeah, circling the Struff match as a big test for him.
Very, very brave of you to say that about a match that will have probably happened by the time most people are listening to this. Couple of last things to touch upon from the men's draw so far. Number one, Matt, you've put this in the agenda, so I assume you want to touch upon the Sheng Mute madness. The floor is yours.
Well, this was probably the best thing that has happened in one of those early stages of a Masters 1000 event, where you're not really into the tournament yet and suddenly you're aware that Sheng and Mute have been playing for 4 hours. And it's like, what is going on over on that court? And honestly, some of the things that happened in this match, Mute demanded coffee and the umpire said, no, you can't have coffee. And Mute said, is that because we're on court 4? And the umpire said, no, we just don't provide coffee. Someone then in the crowd brought him a coffee and he took it. And I was thinking, that's really nice. But also, like, surely you shouldn't be just taking random drinks from people in the crowd. You know, as you're a professional athlete, normally people are very worried about what goes into their body and they're checking everything against, you know, all sorts of possible, you know, doping violations. And there he is accepting a coffee from someone. Very Mute. There was also a moment where mid-rally, Mute got sprayed with water by the guy who was sort of spraying the court behind, because it was the end of the day. He was watering the court and some of it went onto Mute's back mid-rally. And he demanded a let and the umpire gave a let. And then Sheng was like, is that in the rule book? And I think the answer to that is probably not specifically. Like, it's not something you expect to happen for someone to get sprayed with water. But it was a very common sense let for the umpire to call. Mute let go of his racket at one stage, just sort of inexplicably in the middle of a rally after a serve, I think, and ended up kicking the ball back. There were some crazy points. Like, they're both pretty diminutive but great move as an athlete, so it was really hard to like finish the points, and there were some very good rallies. And yeah, it lasted 3 hours 59 minutes, which is incredible, but not even the longest match there's ever been in Madrid, because of the famous Nadal Djokovic semi-final all those years ago tipped over the 4 hour mark. But yeah, it was a fun time, and one of those that won't probably stick out when we come to look back on the year, because it was a sort of opening round match. But at the time, it was a lot of fun, and that's kind of what you want from those matches, I suppose.
It is extraordinary how some players are just magnets for that stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, sure. Some of it they're actively producing themselves, but like Corentin Moutet wasn't trying to release the racket from his hand mid-rally, but he's Corentin Moutet, so of course that stuff just
and of course he's the one who gets sprayed with water.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Last thing to touch upon this is applicable to both sides of the draw, but I think something that was highlighted by a men's match, the awarding of wildcards, not just in Madrid, but I think it's a situation that is particularly acute in Madrid and Miami, which are events that are owned by IMG, which is a sort of multifunctional company that does player management as well as event management. So they own the Madrid event and the Miami event, but they also represent a lot of the world's top players. Darwin Blanche, 16 years old, doesn't turn 17 until September of this year. Never won a challenger level match before. He played two challenges at the end of last year and didn't win a match in either, which is normal at his age. He had only just turned 16 at the time. He played in the juniors last year. This is not about Darwin Blanche not being a tremendous talent that I'm sure will be a worthy awardee of wildcards at some point in the near future. We've been, we're very proud of being early on the Darwin Blanche hype train. We were tipped off about him by Mary Carrillo at last year's French Open, and Matt trooped over to go and watch him and do some of his trademark talent spotting. But it was an uncomfortable watch seeing him be destroyed, manhandled by Rafael Nadal. It was the clearest depiction of man against child that I think I have ever seen on a tennis court. And as I say, I'm sure he will be a worthy recipient of wildcards in the future. But this, for me, and Miami as well, was tremendously premature. And I think premature wildcards risk damaging players. And I think, we talk a lot about the fact that there is no regulation of wildcards. It is totally discretionary. Different tournaments have different policies on it, and it is absolutely not a democratic process. And some people will have strong opinions about that, but it is something we just accept about tennis. But surely there have to be some limits. This kid, this child, is ranked outside the world's top 1,000. And it has highlighted the issue this week, and a few players have spoken out about it, haven't they? David, do you have any strong views?
Yeah, I personally do think IMG overdo it with this stuff. And they've been doing it for years. And listen, it's one of the values of their management group that they can offer wild cards. It's one of the reasons, there's a lot of reasons they get players. They're very good at what they do. And listen, wild cards are an opportunity. They're something that you haven't earned with your ranking. You've got them because you've got this management company and you've got talent. There's no questioning the talent. But I do think it can be dangerous, and that the cautionary tale is Donald Jung, who was a world junior number one. He had countless wild cards given to him at these tournaments, and he just wasn't winning any matches at all, and he wasn't even getting close. And who knows what would have happened to him had he been treated differently at that time. Maybe it had nothing to do with it, but I think it just put him in this spotlight, this glare of attention, where people were talking about him, and his game and his body, he was a relatively small physical man, a boy at that time, and he just wasn't ready for it. And he was playing these guys who were just getting a hiding one after another, and I just think it damaged him. I don't think it did him any good at all. And there are, he's the most extreme example, and there are many, I'm sure, that IMG would cite to me as examples where it's given players a chance and they've taken it and then they've gone on. But prior to Darwin Blanche playing this match, and I realise it's as extreme as it gets, playing 14-time Roland Garros champion, that's as extreme as it gets. But he'd have lost to everybody, I think. He's just not ready, and I don't know how good he is. I haven't had the chance to see him the way Matt and Mary have, but I don't doubt the talent based on what people have said. But it's too early, I think.
There's a big difference, isn't there, between giving Robin Montgomery, a 19-year-old former elite junior, a wild card. Obviously, she's very much justified that. She gave Marina Sabalenka a good run for her money last night, and a 16-year-old who's never won an event at the level below tour level. Those are two very different things. Of course, there's an argument that there's a strong case for giving young players opportunities at that level. But that's what I mean. Surely there have to be some boundaries within which that is possible.
Hmm. Darwin Blanche's two most recent defeats are Rafa Nadal, the one that everyone knows about, 6-1, 6-love in Madrid, and his loss just before that was a 6-2, 6-2 defeat to Darlie Blanche, his brother, which sort of really does sort of point out, yeah, this guy was not ready. I sort of do wonder whether, okay, you know, we can point the finger at IMG there. Is there not some responsibility on the people around him, on the team around him, to maybe think, thank you for this opportunity, but he shouldn't be taking this wild card at this stage? Or is it just too big a thing that you, like, can't turn it down? Are there examples of people turning down wild cards in this sport, or does everyone take them? Because you know, on the one hand, you think, wow, what an amazing experience, he got to play a big draw, he got to see the level, he got to compete against Nadal, and I think you can frame that in a very positive way. But at the same time, it could be damaging, that, you know, in terms of just how out of his depth he was. You know, that's not really an experience you necessarily want to give someone. And as you said, it's not like he's massively ahead of the curve. Like, he's having really good junior results. He did well in the slams last year, and I'm sure he does want to sort of start testing himself against, you know, pros. But that doesn't necessarily mean wildcards into one of the biggest tournaments in the world. Like, there are steps in between that have sort of been missed out there, I suppose.
It's a very good question about turning down wildcards. It's certainly not something you hear about. Whether it happens and we don't hear about, I'd be very interested to know, actually.
I think it might happen once or twice, but at Queens, but not very often.
Yeah, interesting. In this particular, of course, I agree with you, Matt, about people around you. You know, you're a child. You're totally reliant on the people around you. Well, I don't know who his agent is, but his agent is somebody from IMG, and it's an IMG tournament. And as David says, you know, the offer of these, the lure of these wildcards is part of the, yeah, it's one of the carrots, isn't it, to sign with IMG. So I you know, it's fingers and pies and tentacles and all of the things that tennis is so good at. I mentioned Robin Montgomery there. That brings us on nicely to the women's draw, which is very neatly all at the round of 16 stage. We have the following round of 16 matches all taking place today. In fact, one of them's already been completed. Ons Jabeur has beaten Elena Ostapenko very handily indeed. We also have Iga Świątek versus Sara Cerebes-Tormo, Beatrice Haddad-Maia against Maria Sakkari, Coco Gauff against Madison Keys, Yulia Putintseva against Daria Kazatkina, Sara Bialik against Elena Rybakina, Mira Andreeva against Jasmine Paolini, and be still my beating heart, Aryna Sabalenka against Danielle Collins. Clear my schedule, folks. I mean, luckily my schedule is watching tennis, so we're good. But there was a moment last night, we were all watching Jacqueline Christian against Danielle Collins, weren't we? And actually learning a lot about how good Jacqueline Christian is. You know, I was like, who is this woman threatening to end the Danielle Collins streak? And Matt's like, oh, she's actually sneaky good. And I'm like, that's great, but not today, Jacqueline. And look, she is really good. But sorry, Jacqueline, I had my heart and soul set on Danielle Collins, this Danielle Collins, on a 15-match winning streak, taking on the defending champion, Aryna Sabalenka. And that is what we are going to get. And somebody else should take over talking, because I'm breathless just at the thought of it.
Well, I mean, I think with Collins, it's everything, isn't it? It's the fact that there's a finite time to watch her now. She's going to retire in 6-7 months, and that's that. So you want to make the most of it. And every time she plays, you get a reminder of why it's so great. Not only the game, which I don't think has ever looked better than this. She is at her absolute peak when she's 6 months away from retiring from the sport, which I love. I just think that's such a cool thing that she's said, this is happening, and here's my game. And it's won 15 matches in a row against some of the best. And then it's her ownership of situations on the court and her refusal to be disrespected. Like yesterday, somebody has said something in the crowd and she has called them out and said, don't disrespect me. If you want to come out here and do what I do, fine, but otherwise basically keep it shut. And it's just so empowering and satisfying to see somebody refuse to be pushed around like that. And a fully grown human being in every way, isn't she? She's just a proper person. And yeah, some people may not go for it, but that's up to them. To me, she's just the best. I think she's one of the best watchers in tennis anywhere right now. And I do lament that it's not going to last longer, that we're not going to see more of it, selfishly. I'm pleased for her because she's got it all worked out as what she wants in life. But boy, am I going to make the most of this. And her Sabalenka, what I love about Sabalenka is she doesn't take a backward step against anyone. So that is a tantalising prospect between two players who are not doing what Sabalenka did a year ago when she just blitzed everyone. You know, she's having to struggle through three sets, and Collins isn't doing what she's done in the other wins and of her tournament. She's having to fight through. So I'm really interested to know which way this one ends up going.
Matt, care to make some strong predictions about a match that that will have happened by the time most people are listening to this? No, you've done that already.
No, you're right. Like, how it's so hard to call this one. I think Sabalenka's got this extraordinary record in Madrid where she either loses in the first round or wins the tournament. It's happened every time. And she's cleared two rounds here. As David said, both struggles. I watched her match very closely against Magda Linette the other day. You know, thinking back, that was a Grand Slam semi-final less than 18 months ago. And here they were meeting in Sabalenka's first match in Madrid. And She got quite lucky, Sabalenka. You know, there were some very, very timely net cords in her favour in that match. And I really thought it could have gone either way. And then had to battle through last night against Montgomery, probably playing one of the best matches she's ever played. I sort of think Sabalenka's season needed that a little bit, just to fight through some tough matches like that. And it's hard to go against her in these conditions where you know, she plays so well. And yet Collins is such an unstoppable force at the moment as well. I'm just so excited at the thought of it. I think it's second on in the night session tonight.
So it'll probably start about 1 a.m. local time.
Right. There's potential.
Because apparently tour curfew, Madrid is sort of somehow exempt from tour curfews because of, quote, local customs.
Mm. Yeah, there's a snag in the rule book and they can take into account local culture. So I think Zverev and Shapovalov came on around 11 p.m.
They got
local
to enjoy some local
night.
Culture
yeah.
on the local Manolo Santana Stadium in the middle of the night. Great. That match caused David's sleep rating to decline on the day before.
Yeah.
David gets his sleep assessed.
Oh, did it go down?
Yeah. Mm.
And he's blamed Zverev.
It's Denis Shapovalov's fault for getting his serve broken at 3-all. mind you, it's probably a good job he did then, because if it had carried on, it would have stayed up. I went to sleep after he got broke.
You did start out, though, with a score of, what was it, 96%, which might be the best sleep you've ever had that got tracked initially.
Yeah, I think you're giving your wearable tech an inaccurate impression of your sleep habits if you're starting off at a 96%,
David. I'm
making
best impressions.
What's your wearable tech going to say about Sabalenka Collins?
Well, it's just going to have to be put back in the drawer because I'm not missing that.
The women's is really intriguing, isn't it? Because there's a lot of players. I mean, we haven't even talked about Swiatek and Goff because they've just been winning so easily. There's not that much to say other than they're playing really, really well. You know, throw in former champion Ons Jabeur seemingly really hitting form. I mean, that's some win over Yelena Ostapenko just there. I mean, obviously, we've been recording a podcast, so we haven't really seen it. But that's statement stuff from her. There's a lot of good clay court players hitting form. You know, Mira Andreeva's looked really good, and she's needed that because it's been a tricky second season for her since the Australian Open. She's beaten Taylor Townsend, Linda Noskova, and Marketa Vondrousova, who's having a tough time herself. So I think this second week is shaping up really, really nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've got, you know, I think 11 of the top 15, I think I read, are still in this tournament at this stage, which is great. As you said, most of the big names have been really convincing as well. It's been nice to see Goff play well. I think she struggled to close out the first set against Yastremska, but otherwise she's been very convincing. Obviously double bageled Arantxa Rus. Andreeva, what I've been very impressed with is like the resets in matches, you know, where maybe some things have been going against her, and I think a year ago, very, very understandably, she might not have got those matches back on track, but she seems a bit calmer on court, a bit more mature, without having lost her age and what makes her so sort of special as well. She's obviously working now with Conchita Martinez, who was spotted in her box a couple of weeks ago in Rouen, I think, and is now with her in Madrid as well. And hopefully that's a really good influence on her. And, you know, I think it was Madrid last year where I first sort of learned about Andreeva. I think she likes these conditions as well. So, yeah, like there's so much to be excited about in this women's draw. Iga Swiatek, Sara Swiebes, Tormo, just I always find so amusing because it's literally the player who tries to finish the matches as quickly as possible in Iga Swiatek. You know, she wants to be done in under an hour, and Sara Swiebes, Tormo wants you out there for 3 hours, 4 hours if possible. She beat Azarenka in a straight sets match that was just shy of 3 hours. Like, it was extraordinary. And yet Swiatek has actually handled her pretty comfortably in the past.
Yeah, I commentated on their United Cup match, and, you know, I gave it the big one at the start, exactly as you just said, Matt, and it wasn't very good. It was... So that might be when I walk Billie Jean to save energy for Sabalenka Collins. Last thing to touch upon here from Madrid before we move on to a little bit of news. You might remember a few weeks ago we reported on this fact that Madrid is trialling a new doubles format The 32-team draw will feature up to 16 slots reserved for teams entering via their singles ranking, creating an unprecedented number of matchups between the world's top doubles players and top singles players, and compelling new narratives for fans. That was from the press release announcing the changes. So we have teams entered this year comprised of singles players. In the men's, we have Daniil Medvedev and Tommy Paul teaming up, Bublik and Shapovalov, Fritz and Shelton, Dimonor Popperin, and the Tsitsipas brothers as wild cards. So last year, there were still some singles players entering in the doubles. Dimonor and Dimitrov paired up, Khachanov, Rublev. The Tsitsipas brothers played last year as well. Fritz and Tiafo played together. Norrie and Paul, Hurkacz and Shelton, Zverev played with Marcelo Melo, as he does quite a lot. And Felix Auger-Aliassime and Denis Shapovalov played together last year. So certainly year-on-year comparison doesn't seem to have made an enormous difference, quite frankly. But tell that to Bruno Suarez, who has taken to Twitter to say, "I was waiting to see the draw in Madrid to give my opinion on the new doubles entry format. Awful to say the least. Having a combined team of 441 playing there, it's terrible for the sport. Good try, terrible outcome. Mistakes happen for us to learn from them. Let's get back." Does anybody have any strong opinions here? Or weak opinions? I will accept any level of opinion about this.
Well, when I read Bruno's tweet, I went and looked up what it was that the ATP had proposed again. That's where we got that initial line from. And there are other things they're doing as well. Lots of things within the matches to try to reduce the faff, which I think is something to be welcomed and something I'm
You're pressing all my buttons with these arguments, David.
I know, but I mean,
he's gone too much tennis and too much faff.
And listen, that will help it to slot in nicer into the schedule. These are reduced length tournaments generally. They're only Tuesday through Saturday. You can choose whether you like that or not. And obviously, if you're a doubles player, you're not going to like that element of it. But listen, there's no question doubles has struggled. It continues to struggle. It's been struggling for years. So something does need doing. So we'll see how it feels when we've watched these matches and when they've been played. But just in terms of that top one, when I listed those names initially that are playing this year, singles players that are playing, Daniil Medvedev was the one that stuck out. He didn't play last year. And I thought, oh, great. Well, that's nice. So I thought that does seem like quite a lot of singles players. And then it was only when I went and compared it to last year and thought, well, actually, it looks like there were more singles players last year. I mean, I realise the draw is smaller this time, but has it actually achieved what it said it would do in that opening line? I would say not.
I mean, the Masters 1000s do tend to get quite a lot of singles players entering in the doubles. You know, that's not an unusual look of a lineup, I don't think. But yeah, time will tell, I guess. We have some bits and bobs of new bits and bobs. Quite like that, actually. Bits and bobs of news to cover. First of all, I'm going to give you some reasons to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast. First and foremost, we have a live Q&A show coming up for Friends of the Pod next week. That's going to be a general Q&A, Matt, is that right?
Yes, taking questions from the barge for the first time, which we're excited about.
Very excited about. The barge is rocking. We've made some improvements, actually, to the barge this week. It was very exciting on Friday or Saturday, I think it was, where Matt texted the barge group and said, I think, you know, we're in constant discussion, aren't we, with the supporting cast who are our partners in life, in podcasting, and with the barge, and was constantly feeding back on its functionality, and they're working very hard to improve it all the time on the basis of our feedback, which is brilliant. But obviously, some things take more time than others. But we got Barge 2.0 dropping on Friday, and it's very exciting. So yeah, it's a work in progress, but I think that progress is happening, and the people that are on there are having a lovely old time. It's very heartwarming. So, check it out if you haven't already.
And shout out to what Hannah is writing on the barge every week. Hannah is writing, like, previews of the week. She does pod recaps, like, all sort of exclusively for people on the barge. And they're just so great and funny. And that alone, I think, is worth being on the barge, on top of all the excellent chat that happens underneath those previews and reviews. Like, yeah, it's a really good time. And I do think the little improvements we've had over this week will make it even better.
Hear, hear. Yeah, it's a treat for us, isn't it? We're just like you when Hannah's stuff drops on the barge.
I'm on it every day. It's great.
Yeah. Hannah content. Great. So if you'd like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, the link to do so is in our show notes. And of course, you'll be supporting what we do year round and making it so that we can go to the Grand Slams and cover this sport in the way we are so lucky to do.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV, all in HD.
Oh, yes, please.
This is the multi-screen experience of my dreams.
Sure is, Matt. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May the 20th, with match replays on demand, so you never have to miss a moment. And the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. So subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TennisPod20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Some news from the week. A format change for the Billie Jean King Cup Finals. Knockout is to replace round robin. Hooray. The top four seeds will receive byes into the quarterfinals, and eight other teams will play the first round. There will be an overlap in the schedule with the Davis Cup Finals, and the Billie Jean King Cup Finals final will take place on a Wednesday. The draw is happening tomorrow, and I'm hosting it. Hooray!
Hey.
We wanted knockout, didn't we? And we've got it.
Yeah, and I'm quite pumped about that.
Yeah, it needed to happen, and it's happened. It's sort of a rare instance of tennis identifying a problem and fixing that problem quite swiftly.
Yeah, I am.
So that's good.
There's too much round robin in my world, and frankly, I mean personally, I'd get rid of all of it, but. So I'm really pleased that this is happening. I am a little bit taken aback by the idea of finishing on a Wednesday and overlapping with the Davis Cup. And I will, keep my views to myself until I see it, because I think and feel it. But I really just don't want it to feel in any way the poor relation or the build-up to the Davis Cup, which I'm slightly concerned might happen as a result. But I think it's going to be a cool concept, and hopefully it'll mean that those players that are in the WTA finals can all be part of it and not have that as a consideration. But the knockout element is just a win-win for me.
Yeah, you just don't want to see tennis cannibalizing itself the way it did last year with the WTA finals and the Billie Jean King Cup finals. That issue seems to have been hopefully largely resolved, but you don't want it to be replaced by a Davis Cup Finals, Billie Jean King Cup Finals issue. But I have heard they're going to endeavour that the matches don't clash. The scheduling will be such that that that's the case. Might be a bit of a wait and see how it pans out, but definitely pleased about knockout replacing Round Robin. There have been sort of rumours and rumblings about the premium tour in Saudi Arabia in general. Tennis politics. The ATP has released a statement saying, "We are aware of reports in the media claiming that a decision has been reached concerning a 10th ATP Masters 1000 tournament. We would like to clarify that these reports are inaccurate. No decisions have been made and any updates will be communicated at the appropriate time." We have sort of reached a point with all this where we're like, just let us know. Let us know when you know what's happening and we'll react to it. But I'm sort of fed up with expending all the energy of reacting to things that might not be happening, you know?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. The ATP are very quick to release a statement when something's not happening, but can you just please release a statement when something is?
Yeah. So anyway, we'll keep you posted on what's not happening. That's as much as we can offer at the moment. But certainly Madrid is a place where lots of meetings behind the scenes take place. The great and the good of tennis tend to meet during Madrid. So I'm sure decisions were made this week and are going to be made in the coming week. When we'll hear about them, who on earth knows? But when you know, wrong way around. When we know, you'll know. And then, therefore, when you know, we'll know. Oh, dear. Okay. We had the Laureus Sports Awards this week, and Novak Djokovic won Sportsman of the Year again. I've sort of lost count a bit of the amount, the number of times that he's won it. I think he's creeping up on Roger Federer, isn't he? Who won it six
now.
Times.
Yeah.
Five. Okay. So he's coming for another one of Roger Federer's titles or records.
To be as a tennis player, just to raise Roger Federer.
Rafael Nadal or Rafael Nadal's foundation won the Sport for Good award. There was lots of lovely photos of Nadal and Djokovic and Alcaraz with Jude Bellingham, who won Breakthrough of the Year. It was good stuff, wasn't it? And of course, Didier Deschamps also won Sportsperson with a Disability of the Year, which thank you to Laureus and to Dida for giving me an opportunity to say Dida de Groot, and congratulations to her, very, very worthy winner.
It's yet another Masters 1000 event that Novak Djokovic has pulled out of, but then been in the city of, you know, in Miami. He pulled out
like
there and was just on the beach, and here he was just collecting his prize, because it was in Madrid, the ceremony, wasn't it?
They probably arranged for it to be in Madrid because they knew Djokovic was going to win and he'd be playing. I mean, genuinely. And he'd be playing. Yeah, good point. There was also a story that circulated in the Spanish press and in the British press, courtesy of Molly McKelvey, formerly of The Telegraph. She worked for The Telegraph Women's Sport, and she's recently gone freelance. And I wanted to raise this story for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's evidence of what a great addition Molly is to the British tennis press pack, because she's written a lot of pieces like this, pieces that maybe otherwise wouldn't be written. And she's a very welcome addition to written tennis voices in the sport, and I'm very pleased she seems to be doing so well on the freelance beat. But also it was something that I found tremendously upsetting, really, and I just want to highlight it in the hopes of it's being highlighted, perhaps prompting some change. Garbiñe Muguruza, who obviously we spoke about last week, having retired from the tour, she was on the red carpet at the Laureus Sports Award, just absolutely glowing, having recently announced that retirement. And she was asked a question about her weight. She was asked with a load of microphones in her face and some cameras as well. She was asked by one journalist on the red carpet, people were saying they can tell you've stopped training because of the shape that you are in. And I mean, the video is out there for all to see. She dealt with the question with incredible poise, I thought. More poise than that question deserved. And I found it tremendously upsetting, albeit not hugely surprising. I mean, look, all women are subjected to impossible beauty standards, but for athletes they are even more impossible, because those beauty standards are often in total opposition to the physical requirements of being an athlete. I know of female tennis players who, looking back on their career, sacrifice success in order to look a certain way, to adhere to beauty standards and to attract brand sponsors, because of course a lot of sponsors in women's sport are beauty and fashion brands, and they don't want an athlete to actually look like an athlete. A lot of them, they want them to look like a sample size model. And some of the things that Molly quoted in her piece, research telling us time and time again that girls drop out of sport due to body image related worries. And she says, even with top achievers, the issue remains. She quotes a BBC study in March of this year, finding that more than a third of elite British sportswomen they surveyed had experienced disordered eating. And honestly, to me, a third sounds extremely low. I don't have many female friends that haven't experienced some degree of disordered eating in their lifetime. And none of us are professional athletes. So here's Garbiñe Muguruza, happy and blossoming now that she's free from a career that for whatever reason wasn't making her happy. And in that moment, she's asked the most horrifying and degrading question. And for anyone that thinks, well, she wasn't upset by the question, so we shouldn't be, or points to the fact that the journalist asking the question wasn't herself criticising Muguruza's appearance, but merely pointing out what trolls have been saying online. Here's the thing. Whenever you comment on a woman's size or weight, positively or negatively, what you're saying is, I notice and I care what size you are. It's a reminder that the world is looking at your size always. And it approves and values you more highly when you're smaller, and the opposite when you're larger, no matter how healthy or happy you are at those respective sizes. And what happened to Garbiñe Muguruza last week was a very unwelcome reminder of that I think a lot of women will have found very upsetting and very triggering. And I'm so sorry she experienced that, but sadly it's not unusual. But hopefully it getting the attention that it did will maybe lead to some change and reevaluation. Who knows? And just while we're vaguely on the subject of retirement, we're going to lose another stalwart of the WTA Tour at Roland Garros. We're going to be losing Elise Cornet, who's announced that she will be retiring from the sport at Roland Garros, her home tournament. TBC on whether she's going to die on the court. But she's had a heck of a career, hasn't she? She is somebody, look, I don't know her, but I do get the impression that she is going to put her rackets away knowing that she gave everything, you know, and achieved everything that was possible with her game. And I feel like there's going to be peace and happiness there. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I mean, this is a player who beat Serena Williams at Wimbledon, first of all, if we want to look at the achievements element. But she's given us memories, a lot of happy, fun memories that will stick, because she's a bit of a one-off. And a little bit like Danielle Collins, she just marches to the beat of her own drum and If you like it, great. If you don't, so what? Get lost. And kind of, there's room for people like that in every walk of life. And it's great to have someone like that in tennis. And I've enjoyed watching it.
It is always great to have a drama queen for the people. She gave us that and we love her for it. And I'm sure she'll give us one last bit of drama at Roland Garros this year. And that's your lot for this week's tennis podcast, except for our mascot this episode. That is Roxy. Roxy is owned by Jessica. She is Jessica's pandemic puppy, adopted from the Humane Society in 2021. She's a Belgian Malinois German Shepherd Collie mix. Wow. Meaning she's very smart and has endless energy. Her favourite activities include running, hiking, and protecting our home from the Amazon delivery person. Yeah, Billie Jean performs that task brilliantly as well. Thanks, Billie Jean. She's so gorgeous. She's got those pricked up, very engaged ears. She looks like in a former life she might have been some sort of police dog. A sniffer dog, perhaps. Maybe that's what I mean. I think Malinois and German Shepherds are both used a lot in service work, aren't they? So thank you, Jessica, and thank you, Roxy. We will be spreading the Roxy love in our newsletter and on our Instagram this week. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin. David has Francis. Matt has Haida and Soma. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Jeff, Greg and Chris. And just before we get on to this week's shout out, an update from Mary Carrillo on last week's shout outs. Mary Carrillo on the subject of tennis Kathleen says, Kathleen Horvath! Exclamation mark. At the 1983 French Open, Martina hadn't lost a match all year. At the time, was being coached by Renee Richards. Through the first three rounds, she had lost only seven games. Renee assumed Martina didn't need her in week one, so only got to Paris on the morning of the Horvath-Martina match. She told Martina to stay back and let the teenage Horvath make mistakes. Martina lost the first set, but six loved her in the second and lost the third 6-3. Nancy Lieberman was pissing off Renee by coaching Martina yelling at her to be more aggressive. It was a mess. And in the Nick Bollettieri documentary, Kathleen was the player who accused Nick of throwing her into the gutter. But Mary says that she did see Kathleen at Nick Bollettieri's memorial service. So consider us told on the tennis Kathleen front. Matt, who have we got this week?
You see, what we've done there is set ourselves up to have to follow Mary Carrillo, which is something that you should never do. But let's give it a go. And this week's shout-outs are for Robin Hodge in Melbourne.
Hello, Robin. Like Robin Montgomery.
Like Robin Soddling.
Robin Harsa.
Robin's in Sydney, did you say?
Melbourne.
And Robin says, now has a Taylor Swift song named after him or her.
Although actually this is Robin with a Y.
Oh, okay. Like Robin the pop artist. Mm.
Yes. And Robin says, I come from a family of country tennis players, and my late auntie Peg took a set off Margaret Court back in high school in the 1940s.
Amazing!
That's a cool thing to be able to say, isn't it? Thank you, Robin. Love that.
We had an Australian theme to our shout-outs last week, and we've got it again, because we've got Jack Marchant from, now I may be pronouncing this wrong, but Kalgoorlie in Western Australia.
Right, Jack.
Hello, Jack. Like Jack Draper that Matt saw this morning.
Indeed.
Jack picked up a few tips.
Anywhere in Western Australia that's not Perth scares me a bit, because as far as I could tell from being in Western Australia, there's sort of only Perth, and everywhere else is... I mean, if Perth's the most remote city in the world, what are the places that aren't Perth.
I did look up this place, and it sort of defines itself as being 400 miles from Perth.
Which is actually, I think, quite close as places in Western Australia go. Right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack.
And finally, we've got Louise Capp from Parsons Green in London.
All right, Louise.
Oh, it's about 1.5-2 miles down the road from me, and also home to Jeremy Shardy. True fact. Yeah.
And Louise has also got an Australia connection because she completed her tennis Grand Slam in Australia this year to celebrate turning 60. And whilst there, she managed to get front row tickets on the Rod Laver Arena for Danielle Collins versus Iga Świątek.
Oh, you commentated that, Catherine. Match.
I did. It was awesome. Absolutely awesome. God, you must have been hot.
And Louise.
Oh, okay.
Louise knows friend of the pod, Katie. In fact, Louise introduced Katie to the tennis podcast. And Katie's dog, Usher, was our Australian Open mascot this year.
Usher! Oh, lovely. Friends being friends.
Mm.
Love that. Louise, thank you very much. Like Louise...
Pleming?
Pleming.
Commentator and coach?
Very good. Very good, David. Thank you, Louise. Thank you to all of our shout-outs. Thank you to all of our friends of the pod. It is a second week of a 1,000 event, which means we'll be back midweek. We'll be back on Thursday. And then our Madrid Wrap Show on Monday will be live and on YouTube for anybody that wants to come and listen or watch live, or you can listen to it as a podcast as normal. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll be back in a few days' time and we'll speak to you then.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.